Welcome back. 51551 for your texts. On the 26th of July 1914, a shipment of arms landed at Howth Harbour in County Dublin. They'd been smuggled from Germany on board the Asgard, a pleasure yacht owned by Erskine Childers. The operation was organised to equip the nationalist military organisation, the Irish Volunteers. This summer marks the centenary of the Howth gunrunning, an important episode in the struggle for Irish independence. One of the people involved was a woman called Mary Spring Rice, who was a young nationalist activist at the time. And the diary that she kept on board the Asgard is a vivid account of the gunrunning operation.
Saturday, 4th of July. It was distinctly a fresh breeze when I woke up and got what I thought was very rough indeed as the day went on. Erskine, Molly and I felt, and some of us were, extremely ill. Poor Molly had to lie down in her cabin, so was much the worst off. I felt just able to survive while I stayed on deck, and all the afternoon the wind rose. It was southeast, and there was lots of it, and a very choppy short sea into which the Asgard drove her bows.
Well, in that extract from her diary, Mary Spring Rice describes a spell of bad weather while she was taking part in the Howth gunrunning operation. Conor Mulva is still with us. I'm also joined by Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine, and you're both very welcome indeed. Mary Spring Rice's diary is, Conor, a significant historical document. She chronicles the entire voyage of the Asgard, avoiding the British authorities, collecting the arms from a German tugboat off the Belgian coast and unloading them at Howth Harbour. What was she doing on board the Asgard? Who was Mary Spring Rice and why was she there?
So Mary Spring Rice and her cohort really are part of that well-financed, very well-to-do element who were involved in advanced nationalist politics in this period and are able to bring their financial, power and also their equipment. And it's actually Mary Spring Rice herself who first suggests the idea of using fishing yachts for these voyages because, of course, after the Larne gunrunning in April of 1914, nationalists of all hues were looking at ways to emulate or at least in some way arms the Irish Volunteers. And they're discussing the use of various different ships. Can they get a German ship to come and drop the arms? And it's Mary Spring Rice who turns around and says, you can use my yacht. And her yacht is actually not in great nick at this point. So instead, Conor Cruise's yacht, O'Brien's yacht, and also Erskine Childers' yacht are the two yachts that are used, the Kelpie and the Asgard, to go and actually get these harvests of weapons.
Now, there were a number of events that motivated the Irish Volunteers leadership to arm their recruits in 1914. In March of that year, British Army officers at the Curragh Camp in Kildare essentially threatened to mutiny if they were forced. They refused to countenance suppressing unionism and the unionist Ulster Volunteer Force. So Tommy, did the Curragh crisis, among other things, cause nationalists to lose whatever confidence they had in the British military in Ireland?
Oh, it certainly did. And not just that, but the moon music in the background from elements at the highest levels of the British conservative establishment. I mean, it's extraordinary when you think of it now that you have senior elements in the British military, senior politicians, Andrew Bonar Law, I mean, essentially openly preaching sedition against their own government. And I think for listeners, you know, they should bear in mind that this was an issue of democracy, not just for Ireland, but for the United Kingdom. And I think in that light as well, it does raise the possibility, and this is kind of sort of speculation, that the Liberal government may have, to some extent, looked kindly on a bit of evening up of the scales, because there are various conspiracy theories about, you know, that Erskine Childers was a spy and, you know, that the whole thing was a jape. For example, the Asgard had to sail right past Plymouth, you know, where the British fleet is located. Now, mind you, trying to find a yacht in the ocean is like, you know, a needle in the haystack, but circumstantially, it's rather fishy. But the point is that in some ways, the volunteers were arming in favour of the Liberal government, one could say, unofficially.
By the way, I should point out that the original Asgard is on display at the National Museum in Collins Barracks and is well worth a visit. So, I mean, would it be fair to say that, the UVF coupled with the British military who would not act against them, would it be fair to say, or would it be an exaggeration to say that it caused perhaps even a sense of panic in nationalist Ireland?
I'm not sure it was panic. I think it was just that, you know, if what's sauce for the goose, the sauce for the gander, you know. Although, of course, in scale, the amount of weapons brought in by the volunteers was way, way less, and also in quality. I mean, this was a time of bargain basement weapons all over the world.
These were weapons from the Franco-Prussian War in
1871. I mean, yeah. Single shot.
I'm not talking the Enfield.
11. I mean, this yoke had a slug. I mean, if it hits you, it does serious damage. Also, huge smoky. You know, in other words, you're firing this from a window. Your position is given away, and I mean, it does throw into remarkable light the performance of the volunteers, say at Mount Street Bridge. You know, when they managed to hold off the Sherwood foresters. But that's another story. Yeah. And in fact, these weapons will be tested. David Murphy was on to me there the other day, saying there is a plan to test them. So if you want to fire one of these Mausers, apparently, you know, you can write in and ask.
Wear a shoulder pad.
Yes, indeed. Massive recoil, apparently, from
although,
it.
I suppose, just to go back to the question of panic, empirically speaking, we can look at exactly how panicked Irishmen were in this period. And from the point of the Larne gun running and the Curragh crisis onwards, Aegon O'Rahilly states that 1,000 new recruits were coming into the Irish Volunteers every week. By July of 1914, that was apparently, according to one source, up to 5,000 new recruits a week. So certainly, this does cause a massive flocking into the Irish Volunteers. And
I mean,
of course,
there were about 190,000.
Yeah, we're talking 180, 190,000.
More than double the UVF.
And manpower is one thing, and I suppose firepower is the other. And the UVF very much outgunned the Irish Nationalists. However, the Irish Nationalists are mobilised to a level which is astounding. As many people are in the Irish Volunteers before it splits as serve in the First World War from this country. And that's a shocking statistic.
And Tommy, how big was the risk of the shipment of arms being intercepted by the British authorities? Or are you suggesting that perhaps a blind eye was turned?
Well, I'm saying the theory is out there, right? I don't subscribe to it myself, I have to say, because, say, a yacht is a very small thing in the ocean, you know? But I'm just saying that the Liberals would have looked kindly on it, because remember, I think it was confusing maybe for listeners, is that these weapons were later used in 1916, but that's a different matter altogether. As far as the bulk of the Irish Volunteers were concerned, these weapons were being imported to defend home rule, to defend the law of the land that had been passed by Parliament. So these people could see themselves as some sort of, you know, almost like constables, you know, in aid of the civil power, if you like, in contrast to the Ulster Volunteers, who are you know, flagrantly outside the law, you could say.
Now, we'll go back to Mary Spring Rice's diary, and in this next extract from on board the Howth gun-running yacht, she describes an encounter with Conor O'Brien, who's been mentioned by Conor Mulva, who was also involved in the smuggling operation.
Thursday, the 9th of July. Hardly had we finished our last mouthful of breakfast when a loud "Asgard ahoy" was heard. We dashed up on deck to be received with a torrent of abuse from Conor. Why were we so late? Why had we never written? He had spent all his money waiting for us, and de Montmorency had gone back to Dublin. I found to my horror that Conor had been sending a series of wild telegrams to Mrs. Green, via de Montmorency, asking her where we were. If all cows and Dublin, not to say the castle, do not know of our expedition, it is a miracle. The only hope is the government are fairly stupid. We spent rather a harassing morning getting our letters and sending telegrams to figures at Hamburg with final directions about our rendezvous and transshipment. We must have looked a quaint party, Molly and Erskine and I driving around cows, whispering to each other, sending prepaid wires and anxiously returning to the post office for the answers.
So did the Asgard arrive at Howth on schedule?
That's a very good question. Again, Tommy has alluded to the difficulties of the voyage, passing by the entire British military fleet. Another interesting aspect, and Irish Academic Press are actually republishing what remains one of the best books on this subject, which is F.X. Martin's edited collection, The Howth Gunrunning. And that apparently is coming out now, a new edition very soon. In that, we have Mary Spring Rice's diary fully published. The other thing we have in there is an account of a friend of Childers, who was at the time a serving British Army officer, and he was actually on board the Asgard and gets dropped off before they get to Howth.
This is Shepherd.
Exactly, Shepherd, yes. And then the other astounding thing is that the Childers, they don't stop at Howth. They land arms at Howth, and then the Asgard sails away. And where it sails to is Holyhead. And then they get in the train, and they're actually in Westminster in time to see Edward Grey announcing the war.
the speech on the 3rd of August in the House of Commons. Yeah. Right, OK. And Tommy, just put this in a European context for us. I mean, these guns are essentially, they're coming from Germany. So to what extent is Germany complicit in all of this, or are they just bought there?
No, let's just before that, Miles, just throw out the latest sort of theory on the First World War. People, the listeners are familiar with the term the Great War, but John Horne in his piece in the I think Irish Independent Supplement in the War talks about the Greater War. In other words, the idea that this is a much longer crisis that starts in 1912 and doesn't finish in 1923. And in this Greater War, we are front and centre. Mm. In other words, we are the Balkans of the West. We are a crisis waiting to happen.
This is the thesis and, that we were talking about at the beginning of the programme.
So if you look at it in that context, this is not coincidental to what's happening in the rest of Europe. And then the dates are just too coincidental, you know, to be an accident. For example, 24th of July, you have the Buckingham Palace Conference, which is an attempt to bring about a compromise between unionists and nationalists on the Home Rule question. That fails, right? So, you know, civil war seems a step closer. 25th of July, Belgrade rejects
the Austro-Hungarian ultimatum.
26th of July, the weapons are imported into Howth. Not just that, but weapons are then being brought into Dublin, and a few jumpy, I can't remember the regiment, the Scottish
King's
regiment,
own Scottish
King's
borders,
Own Scottish Borders, KOSBs, get a bit jumpy, shoot at the crowd, people are killed, and in the headlines are a massacre in Dublin. So, I mean, you know, the Kaiser's reading this and he's saying, you know, the war has already started, you know, that the lives have been lost. So there's no doubt that this wrong-footed the Imperial Germany, in other words, they expect it, they calculate it, on Britain staying out of the war. So you have to remember that the clock was ticking for Imperial Germany. They had calculated that Russia was about to reorganise by, say, about 1917. They felt themselves surrounded. Now, the point is that, you know, the Fischer thesis that Germany's war aims were aggressive, no doubt about that, but that was inevitable. Germany was late to the table. They wanted the world. Britain and France already had it, you know, as the saying goes. So inevitably, their war aims were bound to be aggressive. I don't think it changes the morality of the situation one whit, to be honest. And going back to a point that, a word that Connor used, you know, this was a systemic failure. I mean, the system was imperialism. This was a crisis of the imperialist system. And, you know, the leaders of Europe, if you like, you know, stand indicted really for allowing this to happen.
OK, we can't talk about the Howth gun running without talking about what happened in Bachelor's Walk. So tell us what happened in Bachelor's Walk and your reference to the King's Own Scottish Borderers.
I would provocatively say to the listeners, Miles, that this is Ireland's Amritsar. What happens in India, the famous Amritsar massacre of April 1919, the same thing really happens in Ireland on a smaller scale. There are obviously hundreds injured in Amritsar, but the death toll in Amritsar that day is 15.
In proportion to the population of the two countries, they're probably similar.
Well, if we are going to go down to those kind of numbers, then the per capita death toll at Bachelor's Walk. So what happens after the Howth gun running is the Irish volunteers take their arms on their shoulders without ammunition in their rifles. The ammunition is following behind. And they progress down the old Malahide Road. There's actually a video on History Hub we made about the historic links here, where as the volunteers progress through Clontarf, they meet a police barricade, and figures within the Irish volunteers, particularly Thomas McDonagh, realises the historic significance of this, and in a moment of elation he compares the day afterwards when he's writing about this, he says this was our Battle of Clontarf. So they meet units of the British military and units of the police, and as Arthur Griffith, who was there at the time and witnessed this, says this was a rifle butt against club and baton. So the standoff develops into this altercation and fracas between the police at Clontarf. The volunteers manage to escape by holding the line, so the actually local volunteer units from around Howth and Skerries hold the front line while the rest of the volunteers jump over fences and walls and escape with their arms back into Dublin. And then as that military unit, the King's Own Scottish Borderers, who'd been dispatched out to Clontarf to stop the volunteers, they then progress through Dublin, and they make a very poor choice in terms of their route. They actually come down Amiens Street, and then they cross to where the Spire is now, down O'Connell Street, and then they turn onto Bachelor's Walk. And when they get to Bachelor's Walk, where the Halfpenny Bridge is, there's an alehouse, there's a pub, and in that pub, a taunting crowds have been taunting them the whole way through, particularly around Amiens Street. These are densely populated tenement areas of Dublin,
and which lose it basically,
and they lose the plot. they attack civilians and they open fire on the crowd, whether it was a soldier with an itchy trigger finger or a major. They open fire on the crowd. And
no, just one small thing. Like, this was condemned by the Irish Worker, but the Scottish Borders were condemned as the scum of Scottish slums, which is rather ironic given that it's the Irish Worker.
It's edited by James Connolly, who was from one of those.
And they,
slums,
they got the unfortunate title of the King's Own Scottish Butchers after that point. But one of the, again, just to underline the barbarity of this, in the inquest after the Bachelor's Walk killings, one of the people killed was a woman who I only found out at the weekend apparently had a son in the British Army. But she was bayoneted and rifle discharged into her while a bayonet was stuck in her body. So this is the level of barbarity that we're seeing here. The figure of three dead is often quoted, but another person dies the day after
and
from 38 wounds.
38 are injured as well.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a significant event, and it does bring Ireland to the cusp of civil war.
Okay, right. Well, we'll see if your Amritsar analogy does provoke a response. Conor Mulva, Tommy Graham, thank you both very, very much indeed for that.